Hello and welcome to this week's installment of Nucleus Investment Insights. My name is Mark and I'll be hosting today's webinar. Today's topic of discussion is, where are all the broke companies? Interesting topic. Today our guest speakers are Jonathan Rockford, Portfolio Manager at Narrow Road Capital, which is involved primarily in distressed debt. Good afternoon, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me on board, Mark.
Oh, glad to have you. And Barry Cogan, partner at McGrath Nickel, the insolvency firm. Good afternoon, Barry.
Good afternoon. Good to be here.
Glad to have you gentlemen here as well. And we're joined by Damien Klassen, Head of Investments here at Nucleus Wealth. Good afternoon, Damien.
Hi, Mark.
Gentlemen, before we start, a quick housekeeping message. A reminder, as usual, to subscribe to our YouTube channel and click the bell to be notified when we go live with a webinar or if there is a new webinar that you can watch. Alternatively, you can follow us on your preferred podcast platform. For those of you listening in live, feel free to drop in your questions in the YouTube live stream chat and have them answered along the way as we go. All right, gentlemen, over to you.
Right, so I might start, you know, just a quick bit of background was, we've spoken to Jonathan before in the past and about this sort of last year, is this whole idea that we had this pandemic hit and then a whole bunch of rules got put on in terms of the sort of preventing other people or companies from going bankrupt. We had waves of fiscal support for companies. We had had big cuts in interest rates. And so that all sort of combined into, and this wasn't just in Australia, this was globally. And so what we saw was that bankruptcies actually took a big tumble around the world. So despite sort of, very rare conditions that sort of and very extreme conditions for most people in terms of job losses and falls in revenue, we actually saw way fewer insolvencies than we have in the past. And so there's some sort of expectation we have to have a payback, but the question is when. And we're still not there. We're still seeing quite low levels, and I guess that's where we wanted to get start by this and bring on a couple of experts in the area. And as circumstance would have it, we've also seen in the last week it's been a slow motion train wreck for a while of the Evergrande and the property sector in China, but it's a good timing in terms of having some experts on to discuss what some of the issues might be and what else we can expect in terms of Australia. So welcome, guys. But maybe I should start giving a little bit of background from how you're seeing the market at the moment. So we start. Maybe Barry, is that?
Yeah, sure. No, happy to talk to that. Look, it's been a very interesting journey over the last 12 or 18 months. When we first went into lockdown here in New South Wales, but more broadly across the country, our phones were running very, very hot. It was, a very unique situation where, every colleague, every friend, every client, even some people you don't recall having bumped into over the years was reaching out, really just trying to understand the landscape, trying to understand their legal rights and obligations, and everyone was very, very nervous. And where that got to over a period of time as all the government support measures came into place was people were looking for opportunities. There was a lot of money kicking around, and so people were saying, we've got money to invest. We're happy to get into debt. We're happy to get into equity. We're happy to get into a hybrid product in between. We have money. Please bring us deals. And so it was really, really interesting just seeing the evolution of, worry, anxiety and uncertainty into, well, how do we make a buck out of this? Mm-hmm. What ended up, I think, driving the very, very low insolvency numbers was a combination of things. From my perspective, the big four banks were very, very supportive of customers. That was for a range of reasons. I think PR had a role to play. I think equally there was a knowledge and an understanding that, you provide support to a customer and that customer is more likely to survive. That, you know, enforcing and putting pressure on both corporate and individual parties during a pandemic was likely to yield a bad result. So banks were very supportive. The tax office was also very supportive for similar reasons. And I think when you look at the fundamentals in the Australian economy around interest rates, strong employment, and the support from government, that really kept numbers at bay. I'm taking up a bit of time. I might come back to what I'm seeing evolve this year. I might just pause there.
Yeah, sure. Well, and I suppose one of the things you didn't mention there was the insolvent trading rules, I guess, yeah, in terms of and also the idea that the insolvent and also the increase in the small claims courts in terms of went from I think $5,000 to $20,000+. And then I think as well, the time frame got pushed out a lot as well. So yeah, you know, whereas before you might have gone, oh yeah, I'll take this to court, I'll get my money back. Whereas you're like, well, even if I will take it to court, it's going to be 6 or 9 months before I'm going to get my money back anyway. And so it sort of seemed as if we had this, we've sort of had this horizon of things are going to be all right soon. And so I think initially there was this pandemic and it was like, well, things will pass soon. And then it was like, well, actually they're going to last a bit longer, but all of a sudden we've got some vaccines and they'll be rolled out soon. And the vaccines are sort of, you know, took a lot longer. And so it seems like we've always had this, oh, it's only a few more months. That sort of kept on. We just can't quite reach that carrot. It's sitting in front of us, but it can't quite get there, which sort of meant that you could hold on for longer. So maybe we'll start with the idea of the rule changes and how much you think that had to do with it in terms of those two different insolvency. Mm.
Yeah, look, I think that did have a large role to play. Probably the most significant one in my mind was to do with the time frame for a creditor who's owed money to enforce. Mm. And so what normally happens is you're owed money by a company, you can file and serve what's called a statutory demand for payment, and the time to comply with that is 21 days. Now, there's a pathway of then going to court and getting a liquidator appointed, but that 21 days is the key hurdle. Now, during the course of last year, that got pushed out to 6 months. And so people being owed money were saying, well, why would I bother waiting 6 months and spending time on legal fees? I'll try and cut a deal, or I'll deal with it later on. So for me, that inability of a creditor to enforce and appoint a liquidator in a timely manner was a key driver, particularly in the SME space, which is where I think, you know, the vast majority of insolvencies happen. I think once you get to larger companies, that's less of an issue. Larger companies have directors who are more focused on, you know, discharging their legal responsibilities. They get better advice generally. And so for them, it was more about the automatic safe harbour provisions, which effectively said, but if you're operating a business in the ordinary course, you have automatic protection around trading whilst insolvent. Whereas the general regime is in place now, is you cannot incur debts at a time when a company is insolvent. If you do, as a director, you can be held personally liable for such debts. And that's always a pressure point for executives. So it's probably been those two measures in my mind that have been the key ones. On an SME basis, really the inability for those owed money to enforce swiftly, and therefore giving people time and space to either do nothing or do something, but certainly not go into an insolvency process. And at the upper end of town, it's been that automatic safe harbour protection. I think they're the key regulatory items, yep, that kept the numbers down.
Right. So, Jonathan, I guess in terms of your thoughts, you know, so you're, I guess coming from a bit differently in that you're looking for these, for companies that are going through these problems and helping to fund them. And so I guess you're ideally looking for good companies fallen upon hard times and can't find the capital. Are you seeing lots of others in your space, so I guess competing for this capital and finding hard to price deals at the right prices?
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. The credit markets at the moment and distressed debt markets at the moment are very aggressive. So the spreads you get paid, that the reward for risk is below average, well below average. So it's a very difficult time to put money to work and do it in a way that's safe and that will get a good yield for your clients. So I guess the answer is, if you're a company that's going through trouble and you're of a decent size, obviously, you know, mum and pop's corner shop isn't really of interest to a private equity firm or a hedge fund. But if you're of a decent size and you run a good process, there will be a good number of people who are looking to insert capital on terms that obviously look profitable for them down the track. And I guess an example there was the insolvency of Virgin. And you had, you know, four parties lined up and two who looked really, really serious and went through to the final phase and that they had a winner. And that was at a point in time when people just didn't know when planes were going to get off the ground again, pretty much. But people were lining up to put capital to work. So there is, primarily as a result of quantitative easing, there is just wave after wave of capital looking for a home. And you see that right across everything from, you know, try getting a decent term deposit rate from your bank, you can't. Government bonds are, you know, awful. Investment grade bonds are awful. Try finding anything that's investment grade rated that gives you more than inflation. You know, it's extremely difficult. So in that sense, you know, just finding assets is hard work, but unless you're willing to take silly risks at the moment.
Yeah. And I guess the question, we'll start with you, but it's sort of then come back to Barry. So that's sort of the picture of how it's been for the last, I guess, 12 months or so, I'm assuming. How about, are we starting to see changes yet from your side, Jonathan?
Changes in terms of more defaults and insolvencies, or changes in terms of margins just keep going down, and that's the way it is?
Well, I guess a mixture of both, in that the insolvencies part, but I guess there's obviously been, certainly in the last week or so, some ructions in some of the high yield markets that are exposed to China, and I guess whether that's having any contagion effect in other areas, that people are actually thinking and saying, hey, yeah, that's right, companies can go broke.
Yeah, look, I guess the comment there would be, what's happening with Evergrande is huge for China. It's almost nothing for the US high yield bond market, for Australian credit markets. It's almost nothing. Yeah. Now, if you were someone who's lending to a sort of mid-tier iron ore company that sits well above the cost curve of others, you might start to have a few nerves now. You know, $90 a ton is still very good, but it's come down from over 200. So you're going to be feeling different. But there's very little in the way of direct instant flow and effect to Australian investors from Evergrande. But it is, I guess it's one of those big systemic things that could trigger something big in China. And then, yes, it does have long-term deep ramifications for Australia.
Mm. Barry, how about yourself? Is there any changes, I guess, what's changing in your career?
Yeah, well, look, I've certainly seen, and the numbers speak to the issue as well, that there has definitely been an uptick in appointments this calendar year, without a doubt. And I think that was really a catch-up of what had to have occurred last year. It certainly remains below natural levels, if I can use that term, i.e. if you take last calendar year out of the equation and look at every other year prior to that, the numbers this year are still below what they were, but certainly above last year. I don't feel like, let's come back to, you know, travel and hospitality and tourism and those sort of sectors, but I don't feel like, because of the issues I flagged, but being extremely low unemployment, very low interest rates, the availability of capital looking for a home, I don't feel like there's a general level of distress in the economy. Where you would think there is distress is hospitality, travel, tourism, you know, student education, retail, those sorts of sectors. But again, we've seen very, very few problems in those sectors probably because of the incentives in place, the support from, you know, landlords, lenders, the tax office, and the ability to raise capital very, very swiftly. So we have seen an uptick this year, but certainly not very significant at all.
So still well below 2019. Still well below 2019 levels. We're talking about.
Let me throw some numbers at you because statistics are helpful. So 2019, 2020, there were about 7,300 insolvencies, and every year prior to that, if I go back about 10 years, it's somewhere between that number and maybe 11,000. 2020, 2021, there were 4,200 insolvencies, so about half the year prior, in a period where we were in recession and lockdown. Now,
So these are corporate insolvencies we're talking about?
Corporate insolvencies.
Yeah. So 600 to 800 a month, I guess, is that right? And so what are we running at the moment?
So July, 613, July, but you look at October last year, 365.
Right.
So there's been a bit of a catch-up. There's been a bit of a catch-up, but still below what we normally see.
Yeah. Yeah, and so it's a question, isn't it? Do you think there's, you know, 2,000 extra companies or 3,000 extra companies out there that just managed to, all they did was manage to extend their life for another year, but they're eventually going to go, or it's genuinely that all the government support and all the JobKeepers and all that type of stuff actually meant that, you know, rather than needing a catch up, it's more of just moving back to normal. And then, you know, I guess what I'm saying is if you took every company in Australia and threw $100,000 at them, or you know, more in some of these cases, then you're basically saying, okay, well, if you are having problems, I've just extended your life for another year. And then so you don't actually need a catch up of the ones that didn't go broke last year.
So I think there's definitely a catch up. Because you look at the fact that we've had years and years of sustainable economic growth after the GFC, and we're still having somewhere between 7,000 and 10,000 companies fail, and last year it was 4,000 companies. Why do companies fail? It's often not because of difficult economic circumstances. It's because they're over-leveraged, they've got into a business they don't understand. There's a product failure where the market has responded poorly to their product because of innovation or competition. And you'd be surprised how many companies fail because of a dispute between the owners, the shareholders, key customers. Now, those issues don't go away because of you know, temporary safe harbour relief or you know, JobKeeper ending up with companies that actually did fine. Those issues stay, but they're deferred. They get kicked down the line. So... There are definitely failures coming. There's definitely a catch-up coming. How intensive that's going to be and how quickly it's going to come is hard to say, but certainly the fact there's money out there to solve problems means that it's not a tsunami but a more gradual catch-up in my mind.
Right. So time to make it at least past the next federal election, I guess, is your...
Yeah, well, who knows when that's going to be.
Well, sometimes the next 6 months, I think they have to, don't they?
But
I guess you're suggesting it's beyond that period at the moment, the way it looks to you.
Yeah, there's just like you think about, again, most of the corporate Australia is made up of SMEs. I mean, that's the reality. They're the backbone of the economy, and when you're in an SME business, often the business is funded through security provided by way of your own home to your lender. And, you know, the gap between what's my business and what's my home and what's my personal debt, what's my business debt, often gets in a pretty grey zone. And we've seen phenomenal growth in house prices, very low interest rates. And so the ability of business owners to leverage against their home to prop up a business and cushion the normal effects is probably, you know, the highest point in recent history. And so I think that provides a buffer. But ultimately these things do need to go through a normal process and be cleaned up, and there will be a catch-up.
Because I think, Jonathan, last time we spoke, I think maybe you were talking about a lot of corporates, a lot of people who were starting to have some problems rather than actually going into sort of a formal version of default. They're sort of basically getting tapped on the shoulder by banks and said, well, why don't you sell your property? This, you're not going to make it. And you know, it's time to clear out and get something out of this before giving it all back to the receivers and ending up with nothing. Am I right in typifying that back to you and whether you're still seeing that type of thing?
Yeah. I might just touch on sort of Barry's previous point there and just say, don't underestimate how enormous job seeker and job keeper were in keeping people afloat. And I can say it from seeing the financials of you know, many, many businesses. You can look on the ASX at companies that got payments. And the government's own numbers that have been released recently, it seems like more than half the people who got the payments didn't qualify.
It seemed like to me basically the reason for getting it was you're a bad forecaster. If as long as you're bad at forecasting your own sales, you managed to get it. And it's actually, in hindsight, I should have put my hand out and said, despite all appearances to the contrary, I am expecting a 50% fall or 30% fall in revenue, and then you're fine. Yeah.
And look, I can just say, as a business owner, I had, you know, friends and well-meaning people say to me, you could qualify for this. Just don't send out invoices, you know, change a few things and you'll get money from the government. And I'm like, I think that's stealing. I won't be part of it. But a lot of people were happy to just put their hand up and say, it's been sprayed around everywhere, I'll grab my share.
Hmm. Yeah, well, and you know, there was an expectation you'd probably have to give it back if that's what happened, and that expectation was wrong.
And look, the short answer to that is we will be paying for that waste for decades. Mm-hmm. It's kept some businesses alive for a little bit longer that probably would have gone under. But you know, you think about the extra taxes you'll have to pay, the less government spending there will be over the course of the next 20, 30 years as a result. That's the cost. People won't see it now. But maybe just jumping back to your other point, what are we seeing in terms of bank land and loans and the like? I guess one of the interesting statistics that come out recently, I think last time at the peak in 2020 was probably something like 14% of borrowers were either in arrears or on hardship. So it was about 1 in 7. It was quite a high number. This year, the numbers that have been reported on residential borrowers, so mum and dad, home loan kind of situation, they're saying it's only about 6% of the peak of last year at this point. So what really happened last year was a whole bunch of people rang up the bank when you know, COVID first hit and said, hi, I hear I can have, you know, 3 months off making my home loan repayments. Can I have that, please? And as a matter of course, they said yes. Now, different lenders had different approaches, but, you know, some people were told straight up, you can, but just remember the interest will build on your loan. So this is not disappearing payments. It's just extending the payments at the end. And so depending on the groups, you know, looking across, you know, some securitization data and banks, you look at the different approaches and you might have had two or three times the level of hardship with some lenders compared to others, even though they look fairly similar. Because some were having that conversation straight up and saying, this is not an escape valve, it's just an extension of your payments. This time around, I think people know that. They know that you can't just ring up your bank and get a holiday and the problem disappears. So the number of people ringing up is much, much lower. What I haven't seen is the numbers on small business asking for hardship help. Not in many angles, it's just in a few. And certainly it's much less, but given there's far less assistance for business this time, there is a hangover of people who got help last year when they didn't need it and they are cashed up now, so their reserve position is much better. So that's maybe part of it, but I think also on the small business side, it's probably going to be more painful this year than last, and I think Barry's numbers sort of talk to that we are seeing more who are throwing in the towel because, you know, there's not the government help.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's I think I looked at the Victorian one, and I think it's you need to have your revenues down 70% now versus before. And I don't know, Barry, you know, you're probably better placed to me. It would seem to me that the majority of small businesses that had a 70% fall in revenue would be giving you a call, as opposed to like, and even with a bit of government support, it's probably 70% is probably a bit too high to actually make it through.
It'd be game over. I mean, no one's making an over 70% margin. So, it just doesn't work at those levels. Maybe just some context to Jonathan's comments as well. I've got some statistics here. So if you look at the number of deferred business loans and deferred home loans, during the peak of lockdown last year, there were 500,000 home loans and 225,000 corporate loans that were deferred. Now, I've got some numbers coming out for the period July 8 through to September 5 of this year, so this lockdown period. Yep. Only 3,600 business loans have been deferred and only 27,000 home loans have been deferred. So a small fraction of what we saw last year. Now, some of that would be where a bank says you actually don't need the deferral. But certainly another part would be people don't request it because they recognise they don't need it. And I completely agree with Jonathan's comments that banks were very, very flexible in helping people through. And some people did take advantage of that situation. I remember speaking with a banker last year who said he had a customer call him up in the pub space and say, look, I'd like a $5 million increase on my working capital facility because, you know, I'm nervous about where things are at and I just need this money. You know, I just need this money. And the banker says, well, let me see what I can do. I'm sure we can give you a hand. And he logs on the internet banking and sees there's like a $7 million undrawn line of credit. And so he calls a customer and says, you've asked me for $5 million, but $7 million is undrawn. And the customer says, yeah, that's just for a rainy day. It's raining out there. It's pouring. And it's just anecdotal that people were just, they were just asking for whatever they could get. And, you know, everyone around them, the sympathy curve, if you call it that, between lenders and the tax office and creditors and corporates and government was at its peak to help business survive.
Mm. Now, I think you were saying as well earlier that you thought it was mainly, it was usually the tax office that sort of started the wind-up procedure. Is that right?
Certainly, if you look at historical numbers, the tax office is highly represented in terms of being what we call the petitioning creditor, the creditor that drives the winding up. Again, I don't have any stats in front of me, but if you were to look at the ASIC insolvency notices, sort of public notices board, if there's 10 or 15 wind-ups a day, I'd say half of them would be, you know, tax office driven historically. Yeah. Whereas now you just don't see any from the tax office at all. Why is that the case? The tax office is trying to help people through. You know, they're trying to help people through. They're trying to give people payment proposals. They're just being a lot more flexible and easier to deal with. I don't think suddenly everyone's paying their tax. I don't think suddenly everyone's interacting with a tax office in a more meaningful and fulsome way than they normally are. I think it's, look, there's probably some PR in it as well.
But do you think is this a policy-led thing, you think, as well, from, like, do you think the word from on high is don't prosecute these things until after the next election, or is it?
I don't know. I mean, I'd be speculating if I linked it through to the election, but certainly I think government as a whole is saying now is a bad time. Like, tomorrow looks better than today, I think, is what government is saying, right? Like, and to your point, there's been a bit of a carrot that's been followed over the last 12 months. And right now, I mean, New South Wales has a Freedom Day coming up sometime in October. So if you're the tax office, you're the government, tomorrow does look better than today because today doesn't look so good.
Yeah.
And so anecdotally, giving someone some time and space to get to tomorrow makes sense as someone owed money. So I think I think that makes sense, and I don't think anyone wants PR around a bunch of companies falling over and employees losing their jobs and being able to pay their mortgage because the tax officers enforced on people. I don't think that's, you know, I don't think that's helpful as well. So I think there's a commercial element around now's a pretty silly time to enforce if you're the tax office, and equally the PR's probably unhelpful too.
And then Jonathan, from the listed market, the larger sort of where market that has debt instruments, is it similar in that you think people have still got the ability to roll debt and they've still got, well, there's more capital out there waiting for them rather than having to go down the bankruptcy route?
Yeah, if you've got a half decent story, roll up to the debt markets and you'll get funding. Probably not from me if it's only a half decent story, but there is a lot of money out there just chasing a home. So
you're going for 51% decent. That's your
yeah. It is a very hot market. I mean, you look at US high yield, and it's always a good reference point, US high yield, because it is a huge market. It's very transparent. And there's so much information and so many people who study it. So it's a great market to sort of test the sentiment. And you're seeing that the margins across US high yield are pretty close to the lowest since the financial crisis. So yep. I'm talking about pretty close to the lowest in 10 years. The covenants that people are applying are as weak as they have ever been. The really, really junky companies that are triple C rated, you know, they can raise money, they can sell bonds. So in that sense, you know, that kind of gives you a global sense. And in Australia, look, we're not as bad as the US. People don't kind of lead or lend with their chin as much. But we do get flows through of capital from the US because, you know, the men and women who work from hedge funds and the like, they look at what they can see in the US and they go, oh, well, we get a 4% yield on this. Oh, in Australia, we get 6. Okay, well, there's currency risk and there's some other things, but Australia's a great jurisdiction to lend in. You know, sort of, I mean, they've destroyed the foundations of the insolvency set up here a little bit, but it's still, you know, pretty good. It's not third world country. So in that sense, you know, people overseas look at a poor yield in their country and a less poor yield in Australia, so we still get those offshore flows of capital. So particularly for the big end of town, there's plenty of money around. At the small end of town, though, it is always a little bit different. If you've got a house to offer, lots of people will look at you. If you don't have hard assets to offer, you know, even if you've got some receivables that you can offer up as security, there's a number of people who lend against that. But if you don't have those, well, chances are you're pretty poorly capitalized and you really shouldn't be getting a loan anyway, so you are going to struggle to get a loan.
And I guess, are you seeing that, Barry, in terms of the companies that you are seeing go in terms of bankruptcy, are covenant light for yours, or is this a different batch? I suppose you're still, the guys that are going broke now are from 4 or 5 years ago, where it might have been a bit better than the ones that got, you know, if you got a loan in the last year, you're hopefully not going broke this year. You hopefully got at least another couple of years to go.
Yeah, look, I think that's generally the case. They're businesses that encountered a problem 2 or 3 years ago, and it's just taken some time as they've exhausted their options, you know, for it to work its way through the system. I mean, businesses that fail within their first year of establishment, usually there's some sort of, you know, crisis, or it's a startup. So they are very much, you know, there's a bit of a lag between, you know, an issue arising and the insolvency occurring.
And it's probably equity at that stage anyway, rather than, like, there's not a lot of people who are going to give debt to a brand new company.
That's right. But I completely agree with Jonathan, and it's a really important point. If you slice and dice, you know, the business community or the economy into different subsectors, you've got large institutional entities that have various options to raise capital and debt more than ever before. And so they don't really have a funding problem at all. On the other end of the spectrum, you've got SMEs where it's all about security. It's all about leveraging their house or its receivables or its plant and equipment. And if they don't have those assets to leverage against, then it's virtually impossible to raise capital. Like, it is equity, and that makes sense. I mean, what's a lender you know, what's the lender receiving as their secondary exit? The ones in between are interesting. And, you know, the ones in between, which is, you know, a very large chunk of businesses, for them it's all about how they do, in fact, access the capital markets. And they won't receive the same cheap capital inflows as the larger players, but nevertheless, it's cheaper than it's ever been before in reality.
Right. Okay, so jumping from the corporates to individuals. So I guess it's most of the themes are the same, but so I think, Jonathan, you do a bit of lending to houses, I believe. Is that right? I don't know what you're seeing on the individual front. We'll maybe start with you this time.
Yeah, so Barry and I have talked about the numbers in terms of people applying for hardship from banks, and that's, you know, around 6% of the peak last time. So that's tiny. It's absolutely tiny. And I guess in terms of the securitization stuff I work on, so I see a lot of things across personal loans, car loans, home loans, SME loans, so quite a good spread. The levels of defaults and arrears are pretty low on historical terms. And I think that's surprising in some ways to some people, but when you understand the Australian framework for lending, we are just not as aggressive lenders as overseas. So, for instance, if you look at like the peer-to-peer marketplace kind of lending where people go and they get, you know, $5,000-$10,000 personal loans, if you look at the risk grades that you can go down to overseas, you can rock up to some of those platforms overseas as, you know, someone who's been bankrupt, you know, 3-4 years ago and still get a loan, it might cost you 30%. Here in Australia, if someone's being charged 30% on a personal loan, one, that's kind of towards the maximum that anyone charges on those loans generally. And two, they're still going to have to show that, you know, they've got some pay slips, they can, you know, they've got a good chance at servicing that loan from day one. And just the levels of defaults and losses you see on those sorts of pools is just a small fraction of the US market. So we just don't start with that level of aggressiveness. People were worried, for instance, that Afterpay and Zip and the buy now, pay laters would see a skyrocketing level of defaults last year. Simply didn't happen. You know, JobKeeper, JobSeeker, people kept getting money come through. And those debts were oftentimes small. So they could continue to put, you know, $50, $100 a week from the government payments that were coming through into those loans and then pay them off in time. So, yeah, we just don't have as an aggressive lending space here. So when things go wrong, there's a lot of people here think, oh, gee, that small business person, maybe they've got a home loan and they'll be in trouble. But I guess, as was mentioned before, they're probably at a 60 or 70% LVR. So the bank just quietly gives them a nudge and says, look, we've given you 6 months, the arrears are racking up. The house, the market for selling houses probably never gets hotter than it is now. Why don't you do yourself a favour and put that house up for sale? So you might see it in the arrears for a while, but then it just disappears on its own because they sold the house. They made a very good profit selling the house. They wonder whether they'll ever get back in again. But, you know, they've cleared the debt. They've got on top of things. The business might have closed down, but, you know, they've paid off the creditors. So in a sense, that's a good outcome. It's a good outcome for everyone that no one's going through bankruptcy. Creditors got paid. Employees got paid. Taxes got cleared. Person walked away with a profit from selling their house, and they can bounce back and they can start again. Whether it's, and it may be they bounce back and just start working for other people, and maybe running a small business is not for that person.
We have a question over here. Has all the cash sloshing around in the system helped reduce insolvencies?
Absolutely, without a doubt. Without a doubt. Cash businesses fail because of cash, but don't fail because they lose money. I mean, losing money is not what one sets out to do, but it's ultimately the inability to pay people that leads to enforcement and failure. So it's all about cash. Yeah. So 100%. I was just going to say, I agree with what Jonathan articulated around, you know, selling a house and paying everyone out. It's interesting to just speculate what happens when home values go the other way, because it's actually the complete opposite, isn't it?
That can that happen in Australia? That's just like
well, and to me, it's the biggest risk, right? Like if you're on a 60-70% LVR, great, and you know things sell quickly, and you know people are buying things online. But say you're on 120% LVR. You know, you don't want to sell your house. You certainly won't do so voluntarily. Does a bank want to send a sheriff over to kick out a homeowner? What does that mean for the business? Like you can see how it goes the other way quickly as well. I think also one of the things, jumping around a bit but on the same point, one of the reasons there haven't been a lot of personal insolvencies, bankruptcies, is because there haven't been many business failures. And the two are actually very linked, because when you're running a small business and you're signing up to a supply contract with somebody or a lease, you're also signing up to a personal guarantee. And so the failure of a business often leads to a bankruptcy. Since 2008, 35% of all bankruptcies have involved a business. And so the two are very, very much linked to one another. And I think property prices have also been a key driver of the low numbers.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, so we've built ourselves a pro-cyclical. So it's all going well at the same time, and then we're all going badly at the same time. And so as long as you can keep things ticking along, and keep those interest rates low, and then it helps the insolvencies. Excellent. So
I might just jump in and just say on that question about cash sloshing around, from the financials I've seen, which is a sample, so it's kind of anecdotal, but it's a decent-sized sample. There are many, many businesses who got JobKeeper payments who didn't have the numbers fall substantially, who have gone on to record better profits than they ever have on the back of the government payments. And that is how much a big deal it is in terms of the money that's sloshing around. So the fact that you didn't have to give the money back if your business kept going along in the same fashion has meant that a lot of people who claimed had the best year they've ever had when they probably should have been having a bad year.
Yeah. Yes. And so, well, but given the withdrawal then, it all comes down to now, as I said, it goes back to normal, but people have been extended for that extra period of time. So actually talking sectors though as well, So one of the things you were saying was about the landlords, and particularly I think last time, Jonathan, we talked about the strip shops were sort of the ones who are really taking it, and we just found out a couple of days ago we work out of a WeWork, and in Melbourne, and that WeWork's now decided to close down after a year of being, I don't know, feels like 20% occupancy. I guess that seems to be the place where that still has the other shoe to drop, I suppose, in terms of those, you've got a strip shop and you've lost your tenant, you can't find another tenant, and so you've been sitting vacant, but at some stage you just got to give up and either, I don't know, turn it residential or sell it. And similar with the office space. So, I mean, I know there's not a lot of gearing. I think, Jonathan, we also spoke, there's not heaps of gearing in that whole office space relative to last time, but revenues are still down. Yeah. So I don't know if both of you have, well, maybe start with you this time, Barry, on your thoughts about that whole, the retail or the office space.
Yeah, so look, I agree with the way that you've described it, being if you're a smaller private landlord with suburban strip shop shopping and your shop is sitting empty, or perhaps even worse, you've got a tenant who's not paying you, who you can't evict because you need to go through, mediations and small business tribunals with, it's pretty tough. It's pretty tough. You need to call your loss at one point, just realize the asset, hope you get your money back or not, because when do you actually get yourself in a position where the asset starts washing its own face? I think with office, with larger shopping centres, the leverage is low, and they are still selling, these assets are still selling at very, very low yields. And again, it's all because of the availability of capital. People are comfortable buying these assets. I mean, shopping centres are trading during, when I say trading, like the asset itself is selling. These assets are selling in a lockdown environment at very low yields. And it's a function of people looking for some sort of return on capital, because sitting in safe assets like bonds just pays nothing. So in a low leverage, you know, strong valuation environment, I think office and larger retail, i.e. shopping centres, are probably okay at the moment. But it's those smaller strip retail, I think those assets are pretty tough.
Right. So I guess what you're saying effectively is, if you're an office and you're getting into trouble, you probably don't have enough. You're probably not so geared. You've got real concerns. You might have lost a little bit on your valuation, but actually, even though you've lost whatever 60% of your rent, you can still just go and sell it for whatever 5 or 10% loss on your valuation and just get out and.
I think that's right. And I don't think people have lost 60% on their rents. I think if you look at sort of CBD vacancy rates, you know, certainly in Sydney, it's maybe 10%. They're not crazy through the roof.
Yeah, but I guess what I'm saying though is if you lost a tenant, say, early last year, you probably haven't replaced that tenant. So while it's 10%, I suppose, as a whole, I guess what I'm thinking is that's made up of people who, have managed to make it through the whole way with the same tenants, and then some who have, like, they lost a tenant and just literally cannot replace that tenant anywhere near the cost. And so they're the ones, I guess, what I'm thinking, is there something bubbling away where eventually they just have to go, look, I just can't keep getting zero or low rents for a while. But you're saying that there's still a decent market for them just to sell it and move
Correct.
On.
Correct. No, you described it well. You described it well when you went through it earlier. The low LVRs and the ability to trade out of the asset at a really good number.
Mm. Yeah. And so then, and Jonathan, any thoughts from you? I mean, if somebody comes to you and goes, you know, Jonathan, I've got, you know, these five a line of five strip shops that I was sort of sitting on and renting out, and only one of them's leased, and do you think there's a market there for people who are willing to lend to that with the view that eventually the retail will come back? Or do you think that's sort of in the space of like, well, I can buy it because I might be able to convert it to something else later, but I'm not buying it on the basis of a retail perspective?
Yeah. Look, I guess I'm in the camp of there's usually a right number for everything. It just might not be the number that you like. And so, for instance, the strip shop, you might look at it and say, okay, what could you actually sell it for at the current time? And, you know, let's say it used to be 3 million, but now there's only one shop, so it's only 1 million, right? So you've seen a massive drop in value. Mm. Well, as the lender, you might say, look, no one else will touch it with a barge pole. I might take a punt and say, okay, well, is a 15% LVR okay? Could I lend 150,000 against 1 million? And you might do something like that in a market where almost no one else will lend anything. And you say, okay, yeah, I think that'll work because. For something like strip shops, ultimately there is a use for it. It just isn't the use at $50,000 a year. It's a use at $15,000 a year. Someone will come along and start a service business in that. And you think about the way the economy is involved. There's a lot of service businesses. Maybe it's a barber, maybe it's sort of hair and makeup. Maybe they can, you know, run sort of a confectionery shop, stationery, massage, you know, all those sorts of service or low-level retail stuff. If the rent is cheap enough, you will get people who will use it. Or maybe someone says, actually, this will be cheaper than getting an office in a tower, and this has street frontage, so people walk by and I might get some clients out of that, you know, like a little account, and, you know, people might just walk in off the street and say, oh, could you do my tax return? Oh, how much does it cost to get business financials done? My other accountant's closed down or he's not very good. You know, so in that sense, there ultimately is a use for it, but the rent might be massively lower than what it was. On the big end of town, I mean, it's very interesting at the moment, and Barry kind of started down this pathway, which is how much space do we actually need going forward? How much does work from home change it? Because if work from home means that everybody needs 20, 30, 40% less space in offices, that is maybe a decade or two decades worth of population growth to catch up. That could absolutely trash rents over a 3 to 5 year period because people sign leases for the long term in those big offices. So it's going to take quite a while for people to really start giving up space and giving it up permanently. So we're in this very interesting phase where we just don't really know how much demand has been destroyed because people have figured out you can work from home.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I guess, I mean, it seems to be most people I speak to sort of are guessing it's somewhere between, well, yeah, that people end up working maybe 2 days, 2 to 3 days of work from home on average, you know, some, yeah, some zero and some 4 or 5, but that probably doesn't mean, let's say it's 2 days a week, that probably doesn't mean a 40% drop in space needed. Maybe that's a 20% drop in space needed. Is that, I don't know what your rough thoughts are on what you're seeing.
Yeah, look, really not close enough to the sort of area to put a good number on it. But if it's something like that, you can understand with office towers that are being completed now that were started years ago. So the extra supply that joins the market plus population growth has stopped for kind of 18 months. The migration has stopped. You know, we're still having babies. The natural demand growth is way down. So therefore, it could be quite a period of time, 5, 10, 15 years, to fill that space back up again. Some of that, obviously, the obvious avenue is conversion from office to residential. If you can get that through the council and do that, you know, the value of the building is worth quite a chunk more if it's divided up into apartments than if it's offices typically. Mm-hmm. And I think a really good example of that is for those who know Sydney well, just north of the Harbour Bridge in sort of Milsons Point area. And I catch the train past there and probably 10 years ago there was maybe 4 or 6 office towers there right near the bridge. And I think most of them, if not all of them, have now converted to residential. So that can happen. Obviously, council approvals and it takes years. You strip the building down and you rebuild it. But there's enough margin in it to make it worthwhile. And if you're struggling to find tenants, then you're going to do that.
Yeah. Now, do we stress, you know, I guess we need to talk Evergrande. And, you know, I guess in the knowledge, neither of you guys are, you know, do a lot of investment in China or insolvencies in China. But, you know, I guess at least, you know, we've taken the view internally that it's not like a Lehman event. It's more like a Greece event. Is the way we're pitching it. In that, look, you know, in Europe post the financial crisis, you know, you had the problems of all these a number of countries running particularly high deficits, and theoretically that could have been solved at any time by Germany sort of saying yes, okay, we'll go and lend the money. But what they really wanted to do was sort of try and bring some more responsibility, I suppose, into the budget process, and so they were sort of happy to let the crisis sort of tick on to the stage where they got what they wanted from these countries, and I guess we're typifying this is a similar type of thing in that we think the Chinese government could at any time sort of solve the problem by throwing money at the solution if they wanted to, but they know there's a problem there, and they know that's it's not a sustainable just to keep throwing money, and so they do want some changes within it, which is why they sort of started their whole three-thread line. So they're trying to walk that line of getting changes made in the industry without sending the whole thing, without creating a financial crisis. And but I guess the risk is that things do get out of control, and I guess as you guys would probably know more than anyone, you know, what sits on the balance sheet of a property trust, and especially something, a property developer, especially one as big as these guys that seem to have, you know, EVs and space stuff and, you know, everything else you can imagine, there's probably other debt behind it that you can't see. So, you know, I guess what do you see as the big things to watch for as this evolves? wants to go first? Jonathan, do you?
Yeah, look, I guess I'd say it's very difficult to know what will happen with Evergrande. So maybe just a little bit of background. Evergrande is the second largest property developer in China. Estimates are that it has around $300 billion US of liabilities. That is predominantly money owed to suppliers, so the workers and the companies that construct the buildings, the apartment towers. But obviously also
prepayments. Yeah.
Yeah. So obviously, the biggest group is trade creditors. And then you've probably got three other groups. People have prepaid for apartments. Some have prepaid completely and they are staring down possibly a full loss of that. You've got banks who've lent to them, and you've also got the wealth management product. So that's a wealth management product is essentially it's kind of like a peer-to-peer loan in a way. It's a retail investor lending to a corporate. So those are your four groups. So $300 billion worth of liabilities. This is a big, big company. Its assets are predominantly in second and third tier cities, and its asset base is predominantly vacant land or partly built towers. So these are not assets that you would be looking at for higher recovery rates in a distressed scenario, i.e. if the economy is distressed and the sector is distressed.
And it's also worth saying it's been sort of in a precarious situation for a couple of years now, hasn't it? So I guess in a way, some of those assets that you're saying it's predominantly in second and third tier cities is because it did have assets in the first tier cities, but they were the ones that managed to sell. You know, the good assets, it can sell, but it's now as the longer you go on through this process, the worse the assets are left, I suppose.
Yeah, that's believed to be the case. So if I was to paint a picture, if I want to give you the most optimistic outcome, the Chinese government, and which can be both the national government and often also the provincial governments and local governments, have quite a history of coming along with a fire extinguisher and spraying cash everywhere when problems like these come up. So your positive outcome is that just happens again. Now, the signs at the moment, you know, everyone's trying to read that the tea leaves as such and figure out which way the government's going. But the signs are that they're going to let some pain be spread around, that people are going to take losses. So that's kind of your positive end. Your negative end is this is like a small movement of a few rocks on a hill that's very steep and it's going to set off an avalanche. How many other development companies in China are similarly leveraged as Evergrande, and their funding has just been completely cut off in the last month?
Well,
how many Chinese property buyers have said, hang on, we have too many apartments in this country. Many of them, tens of millions, are sitting vacant. This is not a good asset class anymore. And those are the things that if that starts, that dramatically changes the Chinese economy. The estimates are around 30% of the Chinese economy is related to construction and property. And another interesting sort of factoid on it is they estimate that around 70% of the household balance sheet in China is property. So people generally don't buy shares, they don't have super. You pay off your first apartment, then you buy another one, and another one, and another one. And oftentimes you can go to the bank and they'll allow you to get good leverage. And in some cases, there's been people who've gone to multiple banks and got leverage multiple times on the same apartment. So those are all the sorts of things that if the avalanche starts, we just don't know where it stops.
Well, that's
a pessimistic point of view.
And my, we've been tracking for a while now the last publishing stuff on the top 20 and the average the average debt to enterprise value, so that the market value is I think 75% to 80%, whereas most companies, once it gets beyond about 25%, you start getting worried. Mm-hmm. And a developer is obviously very much at the risky end of the market. I mean, I think you'd be concerned if you had a real estate trust that had 60 or 70% debt, and a developer is multiples of that in terms of the riskiness. So I guess what it's the it, you're absolutely right in terms of that. Can they keep track of that whole sector is key. But by the same token, there's obviously a big movement over there to say we want to try and enforce some standards and make sure that this doesn't get worse. You can either try and keep throwing money at the sector until it does run into the wall, or try and make a try and make some genuine changes. Barry, have you got any thoughts?
Look, I agree with how Jonathan articulated it. I guess for me, when you think about it from Australia's perspective, we're very linked to China. They buy a lot of our natural resources. They provide students to us who go to our universities and live in accommodation. And they're big buyers of property over here as well. I can't tell you what the stats are, but they certainly represent a large chunk of those that buy brand new residential apartments. And so there's definitely a downstream impact, just a sentiment piece, I think, as well. I spoke to a friend of mine the other day who's looking to buy an apartment. He's like, oh, well, it's now the right time. I mean, what if Evergrande blows up? I mean, what does that do? So it's just that it's the noise and the sentiment as much as, you know, what actually happens in reality as well. And I think that goes positively and negatively, because if there is a fulsome bailout, I mean, everyone will feel on top of the world saying, well, look, China's just signaled what happens if someone gets into trouble. They come and save the day. So I mean, it's sort of a bit of a knife's edge around, you know, whether it works positively or negatively. But for me, it just, you know, reinforces the connection to China and what happens if something comes out of the blue.
We've seen that in the iron ore price. You know, that's been the first thing to get hit, as you would expect, because iron ore goes really, really well when the economy's growing, because you're building things, building infrastructure, you're building apartments. The minute you stop building things, you need a tiny fraction of what you did before. So that's been an obvious outcome that people have tracked over the last month or so.
We've got a question here in the chat. Sam is asking, he's flipping it around from the China to Australia. He said, we've got Australian apartment developers and assets with books and debt on vacant properties, rising construction costs, declining values. I mean, why are we looking at China all the time? What about Melbourne and Sydney, for instance?
I can talk to that if you like. I do quite a lot in real estate. And in fact, real estate often represents, you know, a large chunk of insolvencies that we see, because it's easy to leverage into real estate, and where there's leverage, there's a higher risk of failure. The market is very resilient, very, very resilient. We put some assets to market in recent months, some representing the asset class in the question, i.e. vacant land, and you get overrun with inquiries and people complete on the sales very swiftly. I mean, it's all very circular, isn't it, that there's low interest rates, there's high employment, so people are buying these apartments. And if they're buying these apartments, the developer can work out a feasibility that makes sense, and the availability of capital means they can purchase these vacant sites, and so it all keeps working. You know, the consumer buys the apartment, the developer can borrow to buy the land. They take into account the fact that we've had 20% growth in property prices this year, so they assume it'll continue, perhaps not at that rate, but over time. And so the system works. But if one of those events doesn't work, i.e. unemployment goes up or interest rates go up and your end consumer therefore won't be paying the prices you need, well, your lender won't lend to you, and so it all cascades the other way. And look, the thing about the Australian economy is real estate has been the backbone of the Australian economy, and population growth, largely through migration, has spurred that on. And we've had no migration, no meaningful migration in recent years. And a bit like we spoke about the catch-up on insolvency numbers, predictions are there'll be a massive catch-up on migration when the borders open, because you know, despite the recent lockdowns, Australia's been seen as a bit of a safe haven, a safe place, and, you know, people want to come here. So I don't know if I've answered that question directly, but in summary, the forces are good around real estate at the moment, but that can very well change.
Yeah, and I think that's probably what, you know, there's a theme we've hit on quite often within our portfolios is that, you know, Australia is, and China as well, both are very this, they've got this pro-cyclical elements to it where property prices go up, which means that people can borrow more, which means you don't have to worry about these debt, which means that people, you know, and it all sort of spirals upwards. But when it goes in reverse, it can, that's when you get the opposite happen where that, you know, a fall in property prices, all of a sudden people stop spending, which means property prices fall further and you get the opposite effect. But as you said, you know, it's hard to see a catalyst for that at the moment.
Yeah, it's got to be employment and interest rates. They're really the two drivers. And I mean, there's risk on the downside, right? Because, you know, you've got the cash rate at the lowest rate ever. So it's very hard to say. I mean, maybe we get negative interest rates, but, you know, it feels like there's more risk on the downside, i.e. that inflation puts pressure on interest rates in the medium term. And the same thing with employment. Like, we've got a 4.5% unemployment rate, one of the lowest ever. You would think there's more risk that the unemployment rate goes up as opposed to it's getting even lower.
Yeah. A couple of questions, John, on iron ore, I think. I think there's we've been quite vocal, I suppose, in terms of our iron ore views, insofar as saying there's the issue for us. So let me read out the two questions. There's one: where do you see iron ore prices heading, given the Chinese real estate unwind, and is Australia headed towards broke? And then, do you foresee any outcomes where Xi potentially uses the current situation around iron ore to potentially punish Australia? For me, the biggest factor for getting to take one step outside that is that the iron ore price rose so quickly that you actually didn't have time to put in to build all these new mines that were at higher levels. So the issue is most of the miners are all developing at somewhere between $20 and $50 in terms of their costs, and so the price has shot up to $200. Quite quickly, you know, over the last little while, which meant you didn't go out and build a mine that was profitable at $100 or profitable at $150 or $200. And then as the price falls, gradually those mines sort of start to fall off, which then cushions, sort of brings your supply balance, supply demand back into balance. Most of the issue is actually that Brazil is still ramping up from its problems it had back in 2019 from mine collapses. So it's actually growing its iron ore. It's the other big one, growing from 300 million to 400 million over this year. And so the issue is to get, if you want to take iron ore out of the market, you need to get prices down to $50 or below. Because at $100, they're all still wildly profitable. And so the real question comes down to saying, will the amount of development that's going on in China, will they try and engineer it so that they keep on building more apartments, or are they actually looking at it saying, look, we've built enough apartments. We don't need, we've, you know, there's I guess speculation that there's about 60 million empty apartments in China. That's enough for the next few years. You know, are they happy to go with a much lower building rate? And given that iron ore, I think roughly 50% of the iron ore in China goes into housing. If that needs to decline, then there's still lots more downside for iron ore on that front. If you need to take volumes out of the market, and we don't see Vale, which is going to be growing by 100 million tons this year, they produce it at $20 to $30 a ton, so they're not stopping. They need they'll need prices well lower before they'd slow down. So yeah, so I think there's iron ore. If you're in any way negative on the Chinese housing market, and we are, it's very hard to come up with a good story for iron ore, even at current levels.
I think probably the story that most people don't factor in, that the key sort of left tail risk, the last 20, 30 years is very much of a story of people migrating from country areas to the city in China. Very simple. You see it right through the numbers. As they migrate to the city, you build apartments, you build infrastructure, you need steel. Most, you know, all the commentary I see from the iron ore companies, most people in their economic forecasts do not have the possibility that stops. They simply think that pattern continues for another at least 10, 20 years. And when you look at how China has paid for the growth that it's had up until the financial crisis, it looked like a good emerging economy growing off, you know, good economic principles. After the financial crisis, the growth in debt has been exponential. And so you are starting to get to the point where no longer do people talk about China and how much debt it has relative to other emerging economies. That ended years ago because China, as an emerging economy, is hugely over indebted. So people have to say, oh, well, how does it compare to the US? How does it compare to Australia and other developed countries in terms of how much debt it has? China is not a developed country in terms of its whole national economy and systems, the way people invest. It is still an emerging economy in that way. So in that sense, that risk is that Communist Party's in charge. They probably do everything they can to kind of keep the peace, keep the growth. That means you keep driving hard and eventually you drive hard into the wall. And that's the risk, is that that comes suddenly, perhaps unexpectedly to most, and then you just see the demand for iron ore just fall off a cliff.
Well, and so we've had three times, they've had three goes at this. 2011, they tried to slow down, and then you know, things slowed too quickly, and so they threw the debt at, again. 2015, we had exactly the same problem, and then 2019. So they've actually had three goes at this, and every time they turn around and press on the debt accelerator again. But it does seem to me that this time, look, I expect the same thing will probably happen again. But I think this time each time they've had to push things down further. And I think this time they've got more of a, certainly got more of a narrative in terms of the whole rebalancing economies. We don't need as many billionaires. We need more common prosperity. I think there's a reasonable argument that, you know, while property prices falling, you know, is not good for sentiment and for companies for spending and all that type of stuff, in terms of actually making their society a bit more equal, well, maybe 20% down on property prices or 30% down on property prices and letting more poor people buy property might actually be a good thing. But we'll see whether we actually get there. So, they've had three goes so far and reversed every time. And I think most of the market is expecting it to happen again. But I think for us, they'll need to see more pain this time around. And I think especially because I think the last round was interrupted by COVID. So they'd started it and then COVID hit. And so it was sort of like, we don't even know hit by the dams in Brazil suddenly spiking the iron ore price and the steel price, and then COVID hitting, which meant we didn't really get to see how committed they were to it in that one. So, yeah. Anyway, certainly lots of interesting factors, and we've dragged on a bit longer than what we hoped. So, but maybe Barry and Jonathan would give a quick summary of you know, if people want to hear more from you, where they can get more information or how they can get in contact.
Well, we want to jump in to speak first. I'll take the cue. Please reach out. We've got offices all around the country, but you can find me on my website, legrandnickel.com. Just search for my name on that website and all my contact details will be on there.
And we'll throw links in the show notes for that.
Thank you.
And Jonathan?
So you can find me at narrowroadcapital.com. You can find me on LinkedIn. I post articles on LiveWire, you know, couple of times a month. Also, if you jump on the website, you can put your details in and you'll get the monthly email with the wrap-up of things I've been involved in each month in terms of media coverage and the like. So people are most welcome to do that. And for those in sort of the family office, institutional investor sector, you know, if you're looking for things that have higher yields but with a lower risk profile than other people might be showing you, That's what I do, so you're welcome to just make contact on that front. But maybe as a little plug, Barry, have you got any property that you might be selling at the moment?
we've always got things going on, always have things going on. Got lots of property on the go. With anything that's major, I post it on my LinkedIn as well, so you can find me under my name on LinkedIn, and there's businesses for sale, there's real estate for sale, things come up all the time.
Excellent. Thanks, Mark. Back to you.
All right, lovely. Thank you very much, gentlemen, and I hope this has been insightful for our listeners, and I think I've definitely found it interesting. I think we've never really delved into this side of it. And so thank you, Jonathan and Barry, for coming onto our webinar over here. I think your market news has actually been possibly reassuring, if I could go so far. And thanks again to all of those who have watched this episode live, and for those of you who asked questions along the way. We do welcome your feedback on this webinar and any suggestion for topics that you think we should cover in our webinars. Don't forget to click like on the video now. And finally, if you know anyone who might get something out of today's episode, please share this with them. If you'd like to see more of our previous webinars, head over to nucleuswealth.com/content. To stay up to date on news from us, you can also follow us on social media. Thanks again to our guests, Jonathan and Barry, and to you for tuning in, and for myself, Mark, and the rest of the team. We look forward to seeing you at the next one.